Oakland. NBA playoffs, the Bucks lost to the Celtics in Game 2 of their series, 120-106. Boston up 2-0. Game 3 Friday night in Milwaukee. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, the 18th. Partly cloudy for the morning. Then we have a winter weather advisory for the afternoon starting at 1 o'clock. We're expecting another round of rain, freezing rain, and light snow through the afternoon. Till around midnight, we might see 2 to 4 inches of total snow. High today, 37, overnight low, 29. Right now, wind from the east-northeast at 16. It's a gray sky, 34 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a pleasure when I can say the words. Our morning show guest is Lisa Konecki, who is professor of theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And I am especially excited about today's conversation on a couple of different levels. First of all, we're going to be talking about the play that opens this weekend at Parkside, and it really sounds wonderful. I was telling Lisa before we went on the air that this is one of the first times I can remember reading just a single paragraph summary of a play and just feeling like my breath was taken away. The play is Eurydice by Sarah Rule, and I am just incredibly excited to be talking about this play and very much hope to see it. And so we'll talk about that. We also want to mention at the risk of getting maudlin that Lisa Konecki is retiring at the end of this school year. And so since my professional relationship with Lisa Konecki goes back such a long way to my first years here at WGTD, I hope we'll have a little bit of time to just kind of look back over the long arc of her career in theater, and particularly at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. So we'll do a little looking back as well. But mostly we want to look ahead to this wonderful play that opens this weekend. Lisa Konecki, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It is a delight to be here as always.
Great. And I meant what I said. I read the summary of this play and I'm just blown away by it. And I think maybe one of the reasons why I reacted so strongly is because actually when I saw just the news release that your play, your last play at Parks, it was going to be Eurydice by Sarah Rule, and it just It's one of those stories that's been around forever and ever and ever, and I couldn't imagine why that would be the choice of your final production at Parkside, or presumably your final production. Who knows?
I think it is my final production.
Yes. All right.
Which is bittersweet, I have
sure,
to say.
Sure, of course. But then I read this summary and realized that this ancient story has been given a marvelous, refreshing take by Sarah Rule. First of all, say a word about Sarah Rule. She is quite an extraordinary talent.
She is an extraordinary talent. She's a young female playwright who's had some real success, which is not always easy for playwrights in general, but for women playwrights, I think they have a harder time getting their work published and produced. She's written a number of plays. I think her plays really speak to the contemporary world, but always with a very sort of strange, offbeat take. You are clearly able to follow them in terms of plot and story, but they are abstract in presentation and visually what she asks for. So, for instance, there is a play about a character who turns into an almond. It's just sort of a wacky story that's very funny, but also very poignant. She has just a large body of work for someone as young as she is. I think she's in her 40s, and is done a lot professionally, but also a lot in university theater.
When I looked at a list of her plays, one of the titles that jumped out at me was How to Transcend a Happy Marriage. That's apparently one of her plays.
That is one of her plays. And there's always something offbeat about them. There's always something strangely real and yet kind of from another plane. Mm. And that is certainly true of Eurydice, which works on multiple planes, both literally and metaphorically.
Right. I noticed another title was For Peter Pan on Her 70th Birthday, which...
Now that one I don't know.
So. What an intriguing idea. And I also noticed in a play that's titled The Clean House,
yes.
I noticed this is on her website where you can explore some of her plays. And so I guess with each one of them, they list the names of the various characters. And then it so happens that for The Clean House, right after the list of characters, it says in parentheses, everyone in this play should be able to tell a really good joke. And just reading those words gives you kind of a sense that she's just one of those fresh individuals.
Right. Well, one of the things I love about Sarah Rule is the things that she writes in her stage directions, which are often things that you can't possibly do. But they're things that give you a sense of the feeling that she's looking for. So she really is writing as much about tone and atmosphere as she is about the literal things that actors say and do. So she gives you a good sense of the feeling that she's looking for in her plays. But she also kind of puts it out there so that you can make lots of choices and decisions. And that's certainly true with this play.
Wonderful. So, again, the title of the play is Eurydice. And I think before we talk about the amazingly fresh take that she has on this ancient myth, I think first, just for the sake of maybe a small handful of listeners who aren't real familiar with this myth, I think most of our listeners probably know the basic story very well as it has come down to us. But just briefly summarize the basic story before we talk about her twist.
Sure. So I think most people know this myth as the story of Orpheus. And Orpheus is usually the central character in this myth. So this is a Greek myth. Orpheus is the son of Apollo, so he's the son of a god, and he is a great musician. He falls in love with Eurydice, and they marry. They have this wonderful, glorious love. But Eurydice is pursued by someone who wants her. And as she's running away, she's bitten by a snake, and she dies. She goes to the underworld. And Orpheus, in his despair, goes to find her. He goes to the underworld. He plays his beautiful music. And Hades is so moved that he agrees to allow Orpheus to take Eurydice back up to what we call the overworld and back to life. But there's one condition. Orpheus cannot turn around and look at Eurydice. And I don't think it's going to be a surprise to anyone what happens next. And it's a myth that has, I think, really inspired artists. You were talking about opera. There is at least one other wonderful play called Eurydice by the playwright Jean Ennui. I think it's a story that's captured the imagination of creative people through the centuries.
It really is. I should mention parenthetically that the oldest surviving opera is called Eurydice.
Really?
Eurydice. By Jacopo
that.
Peri from the year 1600. And then what's really regarded as the first great opera, because those very, very first operas weren't so great, but then Claudio Monteverdi came along, and in 1607, I believe, he composed, and his opera is L'Orfeo, but a treatment of the very, very same story, and he does all kinds of extraordinarily groundbreaking things in his score. So this has intrigued opera composers from the very, very start.
And, interesting.
Yeah, and more famous treatments of it came a little bit later, but...
Well, it's sort of the quintessential sad love story. Someone who will go to the ends of the earth and below to recover that lost love with a sad ending.
Right. So explain to our listeners what Sarah Rule has done with this very, very familiar story.
So Rule really takes an interesting perspective. She makes Eurydice the heart of the story, although Orpheus is certainly a very important character. I'm trying to think of the best way to describe what she does. First of all, she has a character who is called the Nasty Interesting Man. And he is really the lord of the underworld. So when they're in the underworld, he plays a character known as the Child, who also says that he's the lord of the underworld. But in the beginning of the play, he is this man who tries to seduce Eurydice, and while she is with him, she has the fall that kills her. So this character is not the sort of typical lord of the underworld. He's played as an overgrown child, and then when he's the nasty, interesting man, he's kind of like a figure out of a 40s movie, trying to, like a shapeshifter trying to kind of find his way. So that's an interesting character. In the underworld, we have a chorus of stones. So like the Greek chorus, there's a chorus, three characters, a little stone, a loud stone, and a big stone. And they are described as being dressed like overgrown children at a birthday party. But the central change that she makes is that she creates the role of Eurydice's father. So Eurydice travels to the underworld, and the underworld has all of these characteristics which we don't think of in sort of traditional portrayals of hell or the underworld. There is a river of forgetfulness, and as characters enter the underworld, they are washed in this river of forgetfulness. And I think the point of that is to sort of allow for these individuals who are still living but living on a different plane to not think about, to not do an Our Town and sort of think about the past that was, but to not be distracted and to just be in this sort of empty, dripping place. So she arrives in the underworld. She doesn't really understand language. She doesn't know where she is. And her father appears and recognizes her, but she doesn't understand him. And in order to help her, he pretends that he's a porter. He takes her suitcase. He builds a room out of string for her to live in. And they interact. And then there is a moment where she finally realizes who he is. It's this lovely moment of recognition. She hears the name Orpheus. She remembers him. She sees her father. She knows who it is. So the play really focuses quite a bit on this relationship between Eurydice and her father and portrays this lovely... with all of the cares of the world away in this new place, they sort of revert back to that wonderful parent-child, innocent love that's really quite lovely. And they find a home there, a home in each other, and it's that's really beautiful. And then Orpheus comes to get her.
So, unlike the typical telling of this myth, where there's no reason why Eurydice wouldn't want to escape back with Orpheus back to her former life. In this case, she is torn between that possibility and the other.
And one of the things that we see, the first scene is they're at a beach, Orpheus and Eurydice, and it's when they get engaged. But there are these little tensions, these little moments between them Orpheus is always thinking. She'll look at him and say, what are you thinking about? And he'll say, I'm thinking about music. So he's thinking about music. Music always is the priority, not Eurydice. And there are these tensions. He wants her to understand his love of music. She wants him to understand her love of books, which we learn really is something that she's received from her father. So there are these little bits of tension. And as her relationship with her father develops and they find that comfort and Orpheus arrives, I think the script leads us to believe that Eurydice, in walking behind Orpheus, she's been told not to call out so that he won't look at her, that she makes a decision, maybe not knowing of the consequences, but she does call out, and he turns and he looks at her, and he says, you know, why? And she says, I'm sorry, I don't know. But there is this sense that, and right before that, she said, I want to go back. I want to go back to my father. And the stones say, you must go forward. So I think there is this sense of, you know, the innocence of that love between father and child, sort of reverting back to that childhood, has something that romantic love maybe lacks for her, a comfort, a certainty. So there is that push and pull that she feels. And I think that's it's displayed in a really lovely way in the play. It's not huge. It's not this should I stay or should I go moment, but it's, you know, it's there and you can sort of see how it builds. You know, I think one of the things that is really interesting is that she wrote this play when I think it's one of her first plays in her early 20s, right after her father passed away. So I do think that that's you can really feel that father-daughter love. There's a wonderful section in the play. Eurydice gets married and she leaves her wedding because there aren't interesting people there and Orpheus isn't paying attention to her. And she gets a drink of water. And she has this monologue, and she says, you know, weddings are for fathers and daughters. That's when they stop being married to one another. And it's this sort of poignant sense of that. And you can really feel it in the playwright. You can once you know that her father has passed away, you really feel that.
Wow. Had you seen this play done, or did you just read it?
I saw the original production, which was in Madison maybe 15 years ago. And I have to say, I don't really remember it terribly well. I remember liking it, but not loving it. You know, it's a play that I saw. But then it was done, and I can't tell you when. I think maybe 7 or 8 years ago, the Milwaukee Rep did a lovely production of it. And then American Players Theater did it 2 summers ago. And I don't usually like to do plays that I've seen a lot or that I've seen recently because you get someone else's concept and ideas in your head. I feel that it interferes with my own creative impulses. But this play, because of the way that it's written, it's each production has been so completely different that after seeing the APT production, which was just really marvelous, I just had it in my mind that this is something I really want to do with college actors. I think it's something we could do in our black box in that intimate space and very different from the things that we usually do. But I have loved it every time I've seen it. I mean, the first time maybe not as much, but I've loved the last two productions I've seen and have just felt that the play really speaks to me on a variety of different levels, emotional and intellectual. That's very engaging, and that's the material that I'm making these gestures that the audience can't see, but I grab onto.
Like a lobster
like
with
a
its pincer.
That's right.
I noticed in reading about Sarah Rule that she's from Wilmette, Illinois.
She is.
And that just somehow made me really happy to find one more person out of the Midwest. Doing groundbreaking creative things.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a wonderful monologue that the father has in the play where he describes what really seems to be like going home, going to his childhood home. And he talks about the directions and he goes through, you know, you drive down this road and you take a right and you cross a river and you come to a brick house. And Jared Langwinski, who's playing the father, who's a wonderful actor, actually looked up where that is and found that it is a real place. And that actually in that town, he went there and he actually tried to follow those directions and find that place that's described at the end of the play. he said that when he was there, there were a couple of storefronts, I can't remember what they were, that said, you know, that had the family name. So she's, you know, it's certainly not a play about the Midwest, but she brings this element of the Midwest into that character and in several things that he says.
Yeah. So what visually are you doing in this production? What choices are you making, particularly in terms of what this world looks like, the upper world where it begins and then this underworld where Eurydice finds herself?
So Keith Harris, my colleague who I've done more shows with than anyone else, is the scenic designer. And we talked about it for a long time. We wanted to do it in the black box because it's an intimate space. And we're actually doing this. This is the first time in this space we've done anything in the round. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I really I wanted that experience in that space. But I also felt that this was a play that you could surround this play. And also a play where it would really be fine for the audiences to see very different things depending on where they're sitting. Mm. So we're doing it in the round, and the play calls for some really interesting things, like an elevator. Eurydice arrives in the underworld in an elevator that rains.
Mm.
So some productions have just the sound effect of an elevator. Some, the Rep did actually had an elevator that, you know, came from the grid that rained. And we have an elevator of sorts that comes up through the ground. We can't come from our grid. So that's a really, really fun moment. And the elevator has all kinds of lights and things in it. Keith's idea was really very much about the layers, you know, so people searching, the layers between. And that's what we've sort of listed as our time and place. So we have candles that come down from above, that hang from above, and candles that come from below. So there's candles everywhere during the play. We have these wonderful handprints. So Keith, in his design concept, talked a lot about doing research and finding these cave paintings that exist somewhere in Europe, of these hands, and they appear to be hands of children and women that were just painted all over a wall, you know, from prehistoric times.
Wow.
And that idea of that historians think that perhaps these were people reaching out to ancestors, you know. So we have that sort of sense of the handprints of those who have gone before.
Wow.
And we have a river of forgetfulness, which is no water on stage. We decided not to try to do that. But we have a river that lights up and is very symbolic in the way that we use it. So there's lots of stuff on stage, but at the same time, we use the whole stage for both the overworld and the underworld. And through lighting and the way the actors use the space, and through wonderful sound effects, the audience knows where we are.
Right. What is the language of this play? I don't mean, obviously it's in English, but is it sort of a antiquated kind of language?
No, it's very contemporary and very poetic. And the imagery, so the play is, as I said, in terms of the plot and what is happening, the character's journey, it's very clear. I don't think an audience will sit and say, what's going on? But the language and some of these elements, like the elevator and other things, is fairly abstract. In fact, I'm going to read a stage direction because I think, as I said, she gives a lot in her stage directions. I meant to bring a script with me, but I didn't. But it gives you a sense of the way she uses language. So this is the moment when Orpheus comes to the underworld and plays his music to be allowed in to get Eurydice. Mm. Orpheus stands at the gates of hell. He opens his mouth. Music surrounds him. Raspberries, peaches, and plums drop from the ceiling into the river, perhaps only in our imagination.
Fortunately, in our imagination.
Yes, and the way that Orpheus finds Eurydice, he has several short monologues. He's always writing her letters. He finds a mailbox, and he puts them in and hopes that they get to her. Hmm. And one of them does, in fact, get to her. But Orpheus finally figures out how to get to her by listening to rain and finding a particular note and deciding that through that note he will be able to descend into the underworld. And he decides to blow through a straw and blow himself through that straw into the underworld. So there's strong imagery, and that exists in a lot of the language as well. there's just some wonderful moments of metaphor that are really powerful. And then there's some wonderful moments of silliness and, you know, the father does the Charleston, Orpheus and Eurydice, and then Eurydice and her father sing songs. So it has the most sort of basic kind of interactions and then some lovely poetic lyrical language as well.
Hmm. How big a cast is this?
Seven actors plus a flautist. So we have a flute player, a live flute player on stage. And that is not called for in the script, but I loved the idea of heightening the importance of music. It's all through the play. I mean, certainly through Orpheus, but also the father and the music that the characters sing. So we have this flute player on stage who we're thinking of as Orpheus's muse. Mm. And so she follows him, and when he's thinking of music, she plays. So instead of having recorded music, we have a Eurydice theme. You know, we have the sad music that he talks about. We've been able to amplify that and play to create that sense of music when he arrives and uses music to gain entrance.
Interesting.
So it's nice to have her there. She adds a wonderful element.
Oh, I bet. And what is she playing? I mean,
flute.
But I mean,
this is wonderful. She's Kimberly, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name right, Hattel, who's a graduate of Parkside in the music department. She plays with the Oscillators and does other musical things in the Kenosha area. She was sort of recommended to me as somebody who could come in and, without a lot of rehearsal time, improvise with us. So she came in with some ideas, and then she and the character playing Orpheus kind of, you know, we had a rehearsal where we kind of figured out what it should sound like, and then she created that music. So it's nothing. And I didn't want to say, oh, let's do, you know, I don't, you know, John Cage or, you know, something,
Bach or
anything like that. So it's just this lovely set of melodies that she's then intertwined and figured out without a lot of direction how they will work. So she adds a huge amount of emotion, but understanding and helps us to see the importance of Orpheus's character as well.
Mm. Wow. So this play opens this weekend?
It does. It opens Friday, 2 days.
And then runs how many?
So it runs 6 performances. It runs Friday and this Friday and Saturday at 7, the next Friday and Saturday at 7. Then Friday the 20th, we have a 10 a.m. matinee. And we end on Sunday the 29th with a 2 p.m. matinee. So we're trying to adjust to everyone's schedule. We really hope that people will come and see this. I think it's very different from the usual, not that we do usual things necessarily, but from the kind of work that's often done in community theater or university theater, at least recently.
And is this the final play of the school year?
The final play of the school year. And it's interesting for a variety of reasons. We usually end with, you know, we do a musical in this slot, or we do, you know, a Shakespeare in this slot. We do something big. This year, our calendar worked out a little differently, so we decided to end with something that was smaller and more delicate. And I think it's actually making the life of the department a little smoother because it's not a show that involves everyone all the time.
Mm.
So I think that's helping some people get through the end of their semester. But it is our last play.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lisa Konietzky, professor of theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We've been talking about the play Eurydice by Sarah Rule, which opens this weekend and runs for a total of 6 performances this weekend and the following weekend. As we mentioned at the top of the show, this also is very likely the last production that Lisa Konietzky will be directing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. She is about to retire. And so we're just going to take a few minutes and kind of look backwards here a little bit. We're going to transcend the river of forgetfulness and just kind of talk about some things and sort of the bigger picture. Lisa Konietzky, for all the times we've talked over the morning show over these many years, I don't know where you come from originally.
I come from the Boston area, a suburb of Boston. Came here in 1985, right out of graduate school. And, you know, it's interesting because I had not been to the Midwest before, and I came to Kenosha on a 9-month sabbatical replacement packed up my stuff in my little tiny, you know, Honda Civic and drove out here for, thinking I would be here for 9 months. And then a tenure track position opened and I applied for it and have been here ever since. So it wasn't what I expected. I didn't expect to live away from New England. I was very rooted in home, but now I'm a Midwesterner. I've lived here longer. This is my home now.
Wow, very good. Well, that's how I started at Carthage, too, as replacing someone on sabbatical back in 1991, and I'm still there all these years later. And you started at Parkside in 85, and I came here in 86. And I feel like one of my very, very first morning show interviews was with you. The earliest one I remember is interviewing you about Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things I remember about that conversation is I remember you very candidly confessing to a mistake you'd made, that when you staged Romeo and Juliet, you staged some kind of fight rather far downstage, too close to the audience. And in retrospect, you wished you'd staged it more upstage because the closer you are to the audience, of course, the more realistic a fight has to be.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, I like this. I like this woman, and I like a stage director who doesn't mind admitting a mistake over the airwaves.
Oh, well, we could do a whole show on all the mistakes I've made over the years. Yeah, I mean, that was a big realization to me. And I think, you know, now we are a very different department, and we have you know, Brian Gill, the head of our acting program, is a stage combat guy. So I don't have to worry about that. I bring him in, and he does that and thinks about those things. But, you know, you just with anything else, with teaching, with directing, you make mistakes and you learn from them, hopefully. And every situation is different. But, yes, that's one of many things that I've learned over the years.
Where did your aspirations for being in theater come from? I mean, was it from a very early age that
you
were going to go?
A million other theater kids, you know, who started doing it in elementary school and fell in love with it. And believe it or not, I was a singer. Sadly, I don't do that anymore. But just as an aside, one of the things when people say, what are you going to do when you retire? One of the things that I really want to do is just join a community choir and start singing again. Because that was a really important part of my life in you know, middle school, high school, and college. So I did a lot of musicals. I went to school. I basically majored in theater. But I became very interested in dramatic literature. And then when I graduated from college, a number of my friends who were a year ahead of me who had done theater and music had moved to New York, not that far a leap from Boston. So I moved to New York with my friends and joined this little off-Broadway theater company where we did a couple of shows. And that's kind of what I thought my life was going to be. But New York City was not for me. I love the city, but I couldn't live there. And I kind of had a crisis of confidence, moved back to Boston, and did the other thing that I'd always done, which was to work in a university. I'd done that summers. I'd done that when I lived in New York. I worked at NYU. And I got very involved in student services. I got a job at Harvard as a secretary. And without going into a lot of detail, I had an opportunity to direct. Harvard at that point didn't have a theater program or a major, so most of the theater happened in their dormitories, which are very different than dormitories here. And the graduate student who had been directing there left, and there was no one to direct a play. And I thought, well, I'll do this. And so I did it for a couple of years. And then I thought, this is really what I wanted to do. And I went to graduate school and got my MFA in directing. But I think it's been in my blood from the time my brother and I did those plays that we forced our parents to watch, you know, as little kids.
Right. So your initial aspirations were as a performer?
As a performer, absolutely.
Interesting. What do you think it was about directing that felt so right to you? I mean, in what ways did you, even as a neophyte with, I should think, scant training in it, found yourself actually comfortable in that role? What was it about directing that was such a good match with you?
Well, for one thing, I would say that at a professional or semi-professional level, I was not comfortable as a performer. You know, I think I discovered that over time. You know, I think some people live with that and, you know, the drive is there. But for me, doing theater is not that dissimilar from being in academia, being a teacher. It's really about relationships. and helping people to come together, to collaborate, to create something. And I liked the focus on bringing people together more than I liked the focus on myself individually. I was more comfortable with that. And I also love being able to kind of lead a group of people towards a creative vision that I got to shape. And, you know, I don't know if the people who've worked with me will say this is true, but I think for me, I felt that I was... For me, directing at the collegiate level is sort of the perfect place to be. I've done it with high school students, and I've done a little bit of professional directing. But there's something about traditional age students who are coming into their own as performers and as artists and helping them to find their true self through that, that I just love. So it just always felt, you know, you try different things and then you try something and you think, oh, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I really have a passion for. But I don't think I ever felt that it was something I wanted to do. I know I didn't ever want to do it professionally. I really wanted to do it in an academic setting. You know, I think if I could, I'd be a perpetual college student for my whole life. You know, I loved school. I love that atmosphere. But I love working with students that age. And it feels like I can really make a difference in a way that's palpable, that I can see.
What about the challenge of working with college-age students, college-age performers, when so often they are called to play somebody who's 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old?
Yeah.
Doesn't that ever get frustrating after a while, that in a sense, not that you're not drawing from a pool of amazing talent, particularly at Parkside over the years, and yet you're also drawing from, in a sense, a very restrictive pool of
a restricted pool in terms of those things, but also in terms of experience, you know, race, ethnicity, you know, that makes a difference. There are a lot of plays that we can't do because of that, because of the sort of the population of people who come to our auditions. And I think, you know, one of the things that I feel really strongly about is that we should do good plays. We should do good plays with characters who are taking important journeys and telling important stories, and we are not professional. So where else, when these people get into the professional world, is someone like Jared, who plays the father, going to be able to play somebody in their 50s? And how can you help somebody who's young and has, you know, limited experience because of, you know, where they've been and their age? How can you help them to understand the importance of an actor's putting themselves in someone else's shoes and not having been there, finding a way to create that? So a great example, using this actor again, since I've mentioned him, is that we had a conversation at the end of a rehearsal a couple of weeks ago where he said, you know, I'm really having trouble with this being a father. I've never had a child. I don't know how to approach that. And so, you know, we had this conversation. I said, it's like anything else that you do. You know, if you're playing Macbeth, assumedly you haven't been a murderer. I mean, you find ways to help the actor to find something in their experience, but to also understand if they were that character in that situation. And they do the best they can. So for me, that's not an issue. I mean, there are some roles that you, some plays that you just say, you know, we don't have a, you know, we don't have a Macbeth. I mean, we did have a Macbeth and we did Macbeth a few years ago, but you're not going to do King Lear if you don't have someone who can at least come pretty far as a 20-year-old to play that role. But that's a kind of extreme case. So I don't really worry about that. I think if we have an actor who has the experience and the breadth of tools to be able to make a good stab at it, that's what we need, you know, who's not going to be shying away from making choices even though they can't quite get there. I don't worry about that.
Over these many years, do you feel like you have directed at least the vast majority of plays that you were really hungry to direct, or is there this long list of things?
Oh, well, of course there's a long list. But I think that this year, getting to do Angels in America, which is really my favorite play, I feel like I have been able to do, you know, the five or six really plays that have been really important to me. I've been able to do them in this environment. There are a lot of other plays that I want to do, and I'm not saying that my career as a director is necessarily over. I hope to keep directing. I'm not sure what that means yet. But I feel like I've been able to explore the playwrights whose work really is important to me. The great thing about being in a university theater is that by and large, you can choose a wide variety of styles and genres. So I feel pretty comfortable with what I've done. I still want to do Brecht's Mother Courage, and I know that was just done at Carthage, and there are a couple of other plays that I feel like, you know, maybe someday. But I'm pretty content in that regard.
Hmm. Have you been able, during your time at Parkside, to experience as much theater as you wanted to away from Parkside? I feel like a lot of people who are in theater, that is a source of perpetual frustration.
Right, right. Well, and sometimes it's, you know, you've been in rehearsal and you have a month off and you're going back in rehearsal. Sometimes the last thing you want to do is go back into a theater and see somebody else,
absolutely,
something else. I live in Milwaukee, so I see a lot of Milwaukee theater. And that's great. I see pretty much everything in Milwaukee that I'm dying to see. There are a lot of things that I would like to see that I miss. I think the real issue for me is as I've gotten busier, my first few years here when I didn't have a family and those responsibilities, I'd go to Chicago a lot. I had season tickets to Steppenwolf. You know, now I don't get to Chicago nearly as often, so there are a lot of shows that I miss. I do try to get to New York at least once a year and have a theater weekend. I was just lucky enough to see Angels in America Parts 1 and 2 on Broadway about a month ago. But there's never enough time to see all the theater that I want to see. So that's something I feel I can do a lot more in retirement.
Right. When you go to somebody else's play, so to speak, are you? I imagine it's tough to sort of turn off your inner directorship and just sit there and be an audience member. Or do you try as much as possible?
I try as much as possible. I say this to students all the time because we take our students to plays, to professional theater, a couple of times every semester. It's sort of a requirement. We go the whole department. And then we integrate that into the curriculum. And students are so critical of everything they're seeing. And I found myself the last few years saying, you know, when I go to a play, my goal is to enjoy it and to appreciate it, not to criticize it. And I really have, I mean, it's a lot of years. I've gotten pretty good at being able to kind of remove my director's hat, unless it's a play that I've worked on or one that I know really, really well. Then I can find myself really being like, why did they make this choice? A good example of this is Midsummer Night's Dream was my thesis production in graduate school. So it's a play I know really well, and it's been done. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen that show. And I can't, maybe I've just seen it too many times, but I can't watch that show without comparing all of the productions and directorial choices, which really ruins it for me. So I try very hard to take that hat off and just sit and be an audience member and feel whatever the production is trying to get me to feel. And I also try very hard to not, while I'm watching the play, think about the direction. Just think, you know, I try really hard not to. Because, you know, I think anybody, when it's your field, it's very easy to go and critique. But I've always loved theater, so why would I want to? Why wouldn't I try very hard to have the enjoyment that I hope audiences have?
Right. As you look back on your many years at Parkside, does any particular production stand out as something that you are especially grateful that you were able to do? I mean, in terms of something that was maybe exceptionally meaningful for you as a director.
I'd say there are two shows that have really stick out for me. One, my second year here, was The Cradle Will Rock, the Mark Bleustein musical, which I did in collaboration with Augie Wagner, who was a professor in the music department, who was a mentor of mine and I was really close to. And I loved that show and the story of that show and that collaboration. I mean, that is one of the most meaningful experiences that I've had. So that really stands out. And I can still recall every moment of that show, and that was many, many years ago.
Right.
And then, well, Angels in America, I've mentioned that before, but Cloud Nine by Carol Churchill, who is probably my favorite playwright, a British playwright who does amazing work, is a play that I had always wanted to do. It was written in the 70s, but a very contemporary play about gender and colonialism and race and all kinds of things. And that was a wonderful experience with a great group of actors. And I really got to dig my teeth, my whole being, into a play that I loved and had a great experience. And I still hear from actors who've graduated, students from our program, and we'll see on Facebook every once in a while, you know, a reference to that play. So those stand out for me. I think, you know, every production is different and has memorable aspects of it. It might be the play itself. It might be an actor. It might be some wonderful moment in the play that's just, you know, for me, there are these moments when I'm watching my show before it closes, because I watch pretty much every performance. There are just moments that have, that work. You know, there's those, you know, not everything, but those moments where I feel like the work of the actor, the work of the director, the work of the designers, we've come together to create this moment in the story that really says something. And those are the things that I tend to remember about productions. So I feel like I have quite a library of great memories, and, you know, some mistakes and some productions that, well, not my best effort. But, you know, that's what creativity is about, right? You know, some things work and some collaborations are just amazing. And sometimes it's just not, you don't quite get where you want to get, or there's a piece that's missing and, you know, you would do it differently the next time.
Right. Although I should think some of those experiences are also satisfying in a different way, where you are buffeted by one setback after another. I mean, you lose an actor or the roof caves in or something or other. And sometimes the effort to transcend the trouble is almost as every bit as memorable as those experiences where everything is in that state of flow where...
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, that state of flow, you hope that you get there. But I, you know, I could you know, chart my emotional progress through a play, you know, that there are times when I'm, you know, feel I'm the worst director in the world and I'm banging my head against the wall thinking, what have I done? I've let these people down. You know, there's sort of a pattern that I go through. But I do think for me, directing is very much like teaching. You have these moments where you're in the classroom, or you walk out of the classroom and you say, wow, that discussion really worked. I can see the students' excitement and engagement with the material. And then you have classes where you walk out and think, wow, I need to do something differently there. So I think the failures, you know, in life in general help you to do better the next time, or find, you know, here's another way that I could have made that point, or that I could have had that actor reach that, or here's a better way I could have communicated what I needed someone to do, or something that wasn't working technically. So all growing and learning experiences.
Profs learn and grow just as much as the students.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if anybody thinks they're done and they know what they're doing all the time, they're probably not very good either at the creative process or at teaching.
Well, fortunately, Lisa Konecki, you're very, very good at both. And, I know students and your colleagues both just deeply admire you and all that you've done at Parkside. And certainly over the years, I've derived tremendous pleasure and learned so much from all the conversations we've had. And so I thank you for that. And I encourage people to attend your final production at Parkside, which is Sarah Ruhl's Eurydice, again, opening this weekend.
Opening this weekend, yes.
If people want tickets, what do they do?
You can either go to uwparksidetickets.com and purchase them online, or you can call the box office at 262-595-2564. And it's really, I've always loved coming in and talking with you, and this has been a real pleasure. So thank you for all the many conversations we've had.
You're very welcome. Thank you again. Lisa Konecki from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Jerome from the horticulture program here at Gateway, and answering your lawn and garden questions and also talking about Earth Day. And on Friday, James Gelber, who is with the United States Department of Justice. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com will give you more information. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. You're listening to WGTDH.